So I'd like to welcome everyone back to this Shamatha practice program based on mindfulness of breathing. And so we're currently in session 5 of 8 sessions. And this one's focusing on the mindfulness of breathing practice in the area of the abdomen. So let's once again start by setting motivation. So we can do this in our own way. Any of you following the Mahayana tradition, then you will know that the highest motivation is bodhicitta, but setting motivation as expansive as possible. So let's have a look at what we'll be covering in this evening's session. As normal, we'll begin with a review of some of the earlier topics that we covered. Then we'll continue with the meditation we did in the last session, that is the mindfulness of breathing in the area of the abdomen. And then the main topic is we'll continue also our presentation of the stages of progress in Shamatha. So we're looking at this classic 9-stage model. We looked at the first 4 stages in the last session, and we'll finish stage 5 to 9 in this session. And then we'll look at the mindfulness of breathing in the abdomen a little bit more, a couple more tips for that practice. And then we'll do that meditation again later in the session, and finishing with question answer as per normal. So again, if you have any questions throughout the session, then you can put them in the chat and we'll try and answer those questions at the end of the session. This is the second of 2 sessions based on focusing at the abdomen. We previously had 2 sessions on the full body breath practice, and then the next 2 sessions will be focusing at the entrance of the nostrils, and the last session, how to integrate this practice into daily life. Again, the recommended reading for this program is this one excellent book from Alan Wallace, Attention Revolution. If you like a little bit more technical information, in-depth information, then you can have a look at volume 3 of this Lamrim Chenmo from Lama Tsong Kapa. So in the Shamatha training, we are covering a number of points. The prerequisites for Shamatha training, how to set up our life to support this practice. We'll be looking at that in session 7. In terms of the actual practice, in the first session, we looked at how to prepare ourselves well at the beginning of every meditation session in terms of preparing body, speech, and mind. And then within the actual Shamatha meditation, we looked at a number of topics already. First, the qualities that we are cultivating in this practice. And as I've mentioned a number of times now, the original Shamatha texts generally talked about 2 qualities, stability and clarity. A stable mind to be able to focus on an object without becoming distracted, but also to be focusing in a very clear way. But we added this third quality of relaxation that you often won't really see in the old meditation texts. And it's something that we really need to pay attention to in the modern world to really establish that basis in relaxation. Without that basis in relaxation, we're just going to have all sorts of problems in meditation, and we're not going to be able to develop any sort of sustainable stability and clarity of attention. So remember these 3 qualities, to emphasize them in this order, like the analogy of the tree, first sinking those deep roots of relaxation to help support the trunk of stability. The stronger the trunk of stability, the higher the branches and leaves of clarity can grow. In terms of objects, the general recommendation for this practice is to use the object that works best for you. The object that is probably most widely emphasized in many Buddhist traditions is the breath, for many reasons. And I think for many of us, particularly in the modern world, at least initially, the breath is going to be the best object to use. And we're looking at that in this program, of course, a number of variations of the breath practice. But also in the Attention Revolution, Alan Wallace particularly recommends two other objects. The one is to observe the mind, and the other one is the resting in awareness practice. Both of those practices also are highly beneficial for us in the modern world. A lot of advantages. We looked at that briefly earlier. And in the Lam Rim Chenmo, particularly in the Gluk school of Tibetan Buddhism, then there's also a lot of emphasis on using a mental image of a Buddha as an object for shamatha practice, again, having its own unique benefits. In terms of tools, we saw there are two main tools in this practice, the mindfulness and introspection. The rope of mindfulness is a symbolism, tie our mind with the rope of mindfulness to the object, and then use the hook of introspection as quality control to monitor that mindfulness, to notice if we're becoming dull or distracted. And then we had a look at the five main faults in this shamatha practice and how to apply those eight antidotes to those five faults. And by so doing, we can slowly move along these nine stages to shamatha that we have begun to look at in the last session. Also, of course, any practice always has two parts, the actual meditation and what we do for the rest of the day. And so we'll be looking at how to integrate shamatha practice into daily life in the last session in this program, session eight. And as I mentioned, stages of progress, we're looking at this classic model, this nine-stage model. So let's have a look at that and review some of the main points that we covered in the last session. So the material we're using for this discussion, there are three bits of material. There's a color, nice color diagram of these the nine stages to shamatha. Then there's a chart that has a lot of information about what happens, the main points at each one of these stages. And then also a black and white diagram with a translation of a lot of these information that we see on the written in Tibetan on the color diagram. And in that chart, the nine-stage chart there, we see that you actually there are two models put together in that chart, the classic nine-stage model, and then the other model that we briefly touched on earlier, the four-stage model, which is the covering the last two columns of that diagram. And that's the model that's used more commonly for observing the mind. So this nine-stage model is really the classic model used particularly for the mindfulness of breathing practice, whereas when we use the mind as the object for shamatha, then more commonly we have a four-stage model to describe the stages of progress in terms of the event perspective. It's really more about how are the events unfolding in our mind. And what we see when we're observing the mind is at the first stage of progress in the practice, there's simply a waterfall of thoughts crashing down in our mind, one thought after the other, nonstop. And if we keep watching those thoughts, they start to slow down a little bit. And so at the next stage of progress in that practice, rather than a waterfall of thoughts, we have a fast flowing river of thoughts. And then if we keep watching those thoughts, they'll slow down even more. And then the third stage of progress is we'll notice the mind starts to calm down more and it's more like a slow moving river of thoughts. We start to have more gaps between when one thought finishes and the next thought starts, more stillness. So it's more like a slow moving river of thoughts. And then if we keep watching the mind, then eventually our mind will become completely still and quiet. And so that is like that slow moving river emptying into a still lake or an ocean. And so this is the classic four-stage model that we typically use in the shamatha practice observing the mind. And also this quality of experience also is relating to this as well. And we see here an attempt has been made to correlate these two models, how they sort of more or less correlate in a sort of an approximate way. And so what we saw here was that shamatha is attained by progressing through these nine stages, relying on the eight antidotes to abandon the five faults. This is accomplished through the six powers and the four mental engagements. So we have Here we have these nine stages from directed attention up to attentional balance. The six powers in this windy road diagram are really the bends in the road that enable the power that enables us to get to the next straight level of road. So they're sort of sequential, these powers, in terms of helping us to get to higher and higher levels in this nine stages. And then the four mental engagements is really how we are engaging with the object. And we'll look at those in a little bit more detail shortly. So what we saw here was, reviewing from the earlier session, was again at the bottom here we have the meditator, the left hand, of course, the rope of mindfulness, and the right hand, the hook of introspection, the two main tools we use. The elephant was the mind. The black color of the elephant was symbolizing this dullness or laxity. The monkey was symbolizing discursive thought in general. And the fact that it's black is symbolizing this excitation, the most common form of distraction that we briefly looked at earlier, that we are distracted by the so-called sense pleasures. And what we see here is that the elephant and monkey at the initial stage are running wildly ahead of the meditator. So what we notice at the beginning stage of this practice is that our mind is completely out of control. And so this first stage called directed attention is where we simply can focus on the object just for even just a couple of seconds. So that's what we achieve at the first stage. We can just hold the object for a couple of seconds and then we completely get distracted. And we achieve that through the power of hearing, of listening to instructions, learning the instructions, how to do this practice. And then we engage in the practice. What problems persist, of course, at this first stage? There's no continuity on the object. We're distracted for long, long periods of time. And so the main imbalance here is coarse excitation. We saw there that excitation and laxity come in three sort of levels. Coarse excitation is where we are completely distracted from the object. So that's the main imbalance when we begin the practice. We're just distracted completely from the object for long periods of time. And so therefore the mental engagement we use here is what's called focused, meaning because we're mostly distracted, we need a lot of effort simply to continually try to focus on the object. So that's what focused mental engagement means. We put a lot of effort just to focus on the object. And so we see here also in this diagram down the bottom here, the flame on the side of the road. And so that's denoting the amount of effort we need in terms of mindfulness and introspection. Because they're not very well developed initially, we need to put a lot of effort to continually hold the object, to keep coming back to notice we become distracted. And so therefore, we have the correlation here with the four-stage model at the beginning, of course, waterfall of thoughts, a lot of thoughts in our mind crashing down on us. So the quality of our experience is one of movement. There's a lot of things going on in our mind here at this first stage. So just to review some of the points here, I'd like to read a little bit from Attention Revolution from Alan Wallace on page 13. He says the following. The first stage of directed attention is achieved by the power of hearing. According to Buddhist tradition, the most effective way to acquire fresh learning is directly from an experienced, knowledgeable teacher. First you hear teachings, then you follow up with reading, study, and practice. The power of hearing refers both to listening to instructions and also to reading about them, especially if no qualified teacher is available. One of the first signs of progress in shamatha practice is simply noticing how chaotic our minds are. We try to remain attentive, but we swiftly lose our minds and slip into absent-mindedness. People who never sit quietly and try to focus their minds may remain under the illusion that their minds are calm and collected. And we looked at this in the last session. He says, only when we try to direct the attention to a single object for minutes on end does it really become apparent how turbulent and fragmented our attention is. From a Buddhist perspective, the untrained mind is afflicted with attention deficits and hyperactivity. It is dysfunctional. And then he gets descriptive here using this analogy of the elephant. He says, like a wild elephant, the untamed mind can inflict enormous damage on ourselves and those around us. In addition to oscillating between attention deficit and hyperactivity, the normal untrained mind compulsively disgorges a toxic stream of wandering thoughts, then latches onto them obsessively, carried away by one story after another. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorders and obsessive compulsive disorders are not confined to those who are diagnosed as mentally ill. The normal mind is prone to such imbalances, and that's why normal people experience so much mental distress. Such disturbances are symptoms of an unbalanced mind. So that's the first stage of a directed attention, where we can barely focus on the object and we're distracted for long, long periods of time. But if we keep applying effort, we go around the corner, the bend in the road, through the next power of reflection, thinking about the practice, we can get to stage two, continuous attention. So what we achieve here is now we have some continuity on the object for up to a minute or two. And so we see this with the white on top of the elephant's head. This is the factor of stability and clarity improving a little bit. What problems persist is we're still distracted for most of the time. Therefore, the main imbalance, still coarse excitation, still focused mental engagement, a lot of effort just simply to keep focusing on the object, and similarly, cascading water of fall of thoughts, as in the first session, in the first stage. Then we go around the next bend, the power of mindfulness. And so now our mindfulness is getting a lot better. So that mindfulness enables us to get to the third and fourth stage. The third stage here is called resurgent attention. And so what we see here is now the rope of mindfulness, of course, is attached to the elephant of the mind. Mindfulness is getting a lot better. And so what we achieve here is that we are now mostly on the object. And when we get distracted, we quickly come back from the distraction. But what problems persist is we still get distracted entirely from the object for brief periods of time. So we still have that coarse excitation, complete distraction, but only for brief periods now. But now, because we're mainly on the object, now the type of mental engagement is what's called interrupted, because we're mainly on the object, but now that mental engagement is every now and again is interrupted by laxity and excitation. So that's the type of mental engagement, but still a lot of movement in our mind, still a lot of thoughts crashing down in our mind. And we saw here at this third stage, the rabbit coming into the picture on the back of the elephant. Rabbit is this subtle laxity. So here in these middling stages, starting stage 3, 4, 5, 6, and so forth, we need to start to pick up more and more subtle levels of laxity. Otherwise, we'll sort of get stuck here. So again, I'd like to just briefly mention a few more points from Attention Revolution here. So this is on page 43, and see what he says on page 43. He says, when you reach the third stage, resurgent attention, during your practice session, your attention is fixed most of the time upon your meditative object. But now you will have increased the duration of each session beyond the initial 24 minutes to perhaps twice that. So why 24 minutes? Is because in ancient India, they didn't have a system of measuring time in terms of hours, minutes, and seconds. In fact, the day was broken up into 60 units, and each unit was called a ghatika. So 1/60th of a day is 24 minutes. So sometimes in the meditation texts, it would say, as a beginner, it would be good to meditate one ghatika. And so hence, then Alan Wallace is using that in his Attention Revolution. That's why we see him mentioning 24 minutes. But he's saying here that even by stage three, we're getting more into the practice. We're increasing the duration we meditate. And what he says is the following. He says, as your attention gradually stabilizes, you may increase the duration of each session by increments of 3 minutes. At all times, though, value the quality of your meditation over the quantity of time spent in each session. If you sit for long periods, but let your mind rove around unnoticed among distractions or fall into dullness, not only are you wasting your time, but you are also developing bad habits that will only get harder and harder to break. So again, quality over quantity. So as a beginner, to start with short sessions, but as we go further into the practice, we will need to extend the duration we meditate to go further into the practice, but always emphasizing quality over quantity. One more thing here is, what does it mean to be at a particular stage? For example, here at stage three, we're talking about that we are probably, we're on the object maybe 5 or 10 minutes at a time. And if we get distracted, we quickly come back. So if that is our normal experience or average experience, that's what it means to be at stage three. We could, even as a beginner, even if we're way back on stage one, we could have in a particular session, one session where we focus 5. Glenn,
we seem to have lost you.
Have average experience. If our average experience is this, we can hold the object for 5 or 10 minutes at a time. And when we get distracted, we quickly come back. That's what it means to be stage three. And so that's the measure of we have at each stage, is that that's the average experience. So now if we move to stage four, called close attention, now our mindfulness is getting very good, so much so that now we can hold the object the entire session without ever completely losing it, because our mindfulness is getting a lot better. What problem persists here at stage four, though, is we have some complacency regarding the practice. Because we're not getting distracted, we can get a little bit complacent, think, well, you know, I think I'm getting close to shamatha now, and sort of get a bit complacent about the practice. So the imbalance now is we still have coarse laxity. So coarse laxity, remember, was the mind sinking quite a lot, just about disengaging from the object, hardly holding the object because our mind is sinking a lot. Medium excitation was we don't completely lose the object, but maybe we start to entertain other thoughts and they are maybe our main focus, but still a little bit in the corner of our mind, we are still holding the breath. We're noticing the breath. That's medium excitation, where the object is displaced to the periphery and we're mainly focusing on a distraction. So this is even the case at stage four. Mental engagement, of course, still interrupted because we're still interrupted by excitation and laxity. But now the quality of our experience is one of achievement, when we feel like we're no longer a beginner anymore, that we're really getting somewhere in the shamatha practice. And now the mind, the amount of thoughts has started to calm down. And so instead of a waterfall of thoughts, now it's more like a fast flowing river of thoughts. But we really, really are making good progress now. So that's where we left off the first four stages in the last session. So let's go back to the meditation we started last session. So that's the mindfulness of breathing, focusing at the abdomen. So the object, remember here, is the tactile sensations of the rising and lowering of the abdomen. Again, we're using bare attention, directly observing those sensations. So we're not visualizing the breath. We're not imagining the movement of the abdomen. We're focusing on the actual tactile sensations of the rising and lowering of the abdomen. And so here the emphasis is on stability of attention, but balance. Don't forget the balance. So we don't want to enhance stability at the cost of losing relaxation. So maintaining that basis in relaxation. And again, when we find those two imbalances of excitation and distraction, the relax, release, return, falling into dullness or laxity, refresh, restore, retain. And we introduced that short-term strategy in the last session to count the breath. If we find ourselves heavily distracted, then counting the breath can be helpful to improve stability of attention. So if you want to, if you find yourself distracted a lot in this session and you find it helpful, you can bring in counting the breath. But remember, it's not mindfulness of counting. So this, the main object is still the sensations of the breath. We're only counting at the end of the in-breath. So remember the system we used last time, counting from 1 up to 10 and go back to 1 again. So let's do that practice again. So if you'd like to find a nice comfortable posture, let's begin. We begin by preparing the body, setting the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. A vigilant posture is to keep the back nice and straight, and at the same time, allow the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And if you find it helpful, you can take 3 slow, deep breaths, maintaining awareness of sensations throughout the body as you breathe. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. and setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the stillness of the present moment. The mind relaxed, still, and clear. Now, whilst maintaining a relaxed body and a relaxed mind, bring your attention to the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. And focus on the sensations of the rising and lowering of the abdomen as you breathe. Maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. And monitoring that mindfulness with introspection, noticing if you're becoming dull or distracted. And if you notice any agitation, tension, or distraction, the very first thing to do is simply relax. Then release the distraction and very gently return to the breath. So relax, release, and return. Keep coming back to the breath again and again, each time you get distracted. And if you find yourself constantly becoming distracted, you might like to experiment with counting the breath to help stabilize the attention. we can bring the meditation to a close. Let's continue our discussion of this nine-stage model. So it's the classic model that's used, particularly in conjunction with the mindfulness of breathing shamatha practice. And we can begin with a quote here from Lamrim Chenmo from Tsongkhapa. He says, "It is not enough just to have an understanding of laxity in excitation. You have to be able to develop introspection that accurately detects whether laxity in excitation is present during meditation." Remember, we saw that there are a number of levels of laxity in excitation. And the beginning stages of this practice, in the first couple of stages, as we saw, we tend to have like coarse excitation, completely distracted, coarse laxity, heavy sinking to the point where we even maybe just about fall asleep in meditation. But now we've covered up to stage four. And after stage four, from stage five on, we've eliminated both coarse laxity, coarse excitation. So now we have to develop introspection more and more finely to be able to pick up more and more fine levels of excitation and laxity to go to the higher levels. And so here's some advice from Panchen Losen Cheki Gyaltsen, again, the 16th century Gelug master. In his Mahamudra text, the Shamatha section, he says, "If your focus is too tight and you think that excitation is arising, relax it a little. If your focus is too loose and you think that laxity is arising, tighten it a little." So here we often find, and this is what we're doing in these middling stages, we're fine-tuning our focus. And the analogy often given here is the analogy of a guitar string. If a guitar string, or I think in the old text they talked about a string of a lute, if it's too tight or too loose, it doesn't play well. Similarly, if our mind is too tight or too loose, it doesn't focus well. So if it's a bit tight, it'll get agitated excitation. We loosen it, relax. If we relax too much, we'll start sinking. So then we need to tighten it a bit. So we're constantly fine-tuning. And this is a very difficult to do at the higher levels, to really fine-tune fine-tune our mind like fine-tuning a guitar string. You know, I think that a beginner who's tuning, for example, a guitar string would tune it and go, right, that's correct. But then an expert would go, no, that's nowhere near tuned. You need to tune it even more. We can't even pick that up as a beginner. Similarly here. In fact, he's quoting here from a great 7th century Indian master, Chandra Goman. Panchen Losen Cheki Gyaltsen quotes him. There was a bit more. He says, "By finding a balance between the two, the mind is drawn away from the movement of thoughts. However, it is necessary to be cautious of laxity when there is a factor of stillness." So once our mind gets focused and starts to become more clear and more still, it's very easy to sink into dullness, into laxity. So to be watchful for that. And then he's quoting this great 7th century Indian Buddhist master, Chandra Goman, who says, "If I rely upon exertion, excitation will arise. And if I give it up, laxity will occur. Since it is difficult to find an appropriate balance, what should I do with my agitated mind?" So therefore, this is only something that we can develop through practice, this ability to fine-tune more and more and more. And that's what we're really doing over these middling stages here, is really fine-tuning the mind. So remember just these three levels of excitation and three levels of laxity. So from stage five onwards, both coarse excitation, coarse laxity have been eliminated. Medium excitation is where we start to get pulled away by something, and we're mainly focusing on that and just a little bit still holding on to the object. Whereas subtle excitation is the reverse. We're mainly focusing on object, but there's a little bit of background noise still going on that's sort of pulling our attention a little bit. So that's subtle excitation. Medium level of laxity is the object appears, but there's not a lot of clarity or vividness. It's there, we're on the object, but it's not very clear. Subtle laxity is where the object is very clear, but our attention is slightly slack. So these are the challenges we're facing in the coming stages. So let's look at stage five, tamed attention. So here we're going around the corner of the road again, and this corner is the power of introspection. So now our introspection is honing in, fine-tuning, picking up more and more subtle levels of excitation and laxity. And we see this in stage five and six. Now the hook of introspection is much more prominent, that we're fine-tuning the mind. But before we go to stage five, I'd like to have a look at something in the diagram here. If you look at this color diagram, top left corner of it, you see a monkey in a tree holding some fruit. And if we look at the black and white copy of that, it has, there's a lot of writing there. The translation of that is number 19. So anyone who has that can have a look on the back. And number 19 says, since virtuous thoughts are an interruption at the time of shamatha meditation, it is necessary to stop them. At other times, it is not necessary. What this means is, and maybe many of you have already experienced this, as we start to get into this practice and we start to go beyond the beginning stages and our mind becomes much more stable and clear, what starts to happen is all these things start to come up in our mind. All these great ideas, solutions to problems, virtuous thoughts are coming up from a deeper level of our mind because we're really opening the door to our intuition, our inner wisdom. So often in the middle of meditation, then woof, here comes a great idea. Here comes a solution to a problem I've been thinking about for the last 3 weeks. But what this is saying here is that this is not the right time to entertain these thoughts. So if some virtuous thought or great idea comes up in the middle of the shamatha practice, you go, good, I'll attend to that after the meditation, let it go and go back to the object. Otherwise, we'll get caught up in all these great ideas and we'll not progress in shamatha. If we're worried about forgetting the good idea, you can even have a little notepad next to where you meditate, write down a few key words and go back to your practice. So this is what the monkey in the tree with the fruit is all about. So let's go to stage five now, tamed attention. So now what we achieve here is we achieve satisfaction in this practice. Before we, in stage four, remember the problem was we got a little bit complacent. Now we're really having a lot of satisfaction in the samadhi. And the power by which we get to stage five is introspection. It's getting a lot better. What problems persist is that even though we have a lot of satisfaction in the practice, there's still some resistance to the practice. There's still some resistance there. Now the imbalances are this medium laxity and medium excitation. So the mental engagement is still interrupted, meaning our engagement on the object is still interrupted, in this case here by medium laxity and medium excitation. The quality of our experience, again, sense of achievement, and like stage four, still have a fast flowing river of thoughts moving through the mind. So just to read a little bit more about stage five here from Attention Revolution, this is on page 77. So let's have a look at that. He says, through the skillful sustained practice, and he says of settling the mind in its natural state. So remember, his recommendation was for the first four, or one recommendation Alan Wallace had was use breath for the first four stages. Once you get to stage four, your mind is much more stable. Then we can move on to the practice of observing the mind, which he calls here settling the mind in its natural state. So he says, eventually you will achieve the fifth attentional stage called tamed attention. At this point, you find that you can take satisfaction in your practice, even though there is still some resistance to it. You have progressed well in this path, and the results of your efforts are apparent to you. Involuntary thoughts continue to arise, but instead of their tumultuous outpouring like a cascading waterfall, they now flow like a river moving slowly through a gorge. As you progress from the fourth to the fifth stage, you are presented with one of the greatest challenges on the entire path to shamatha. Free of coarse excitation, you must now confront another problem that was lurking in the shadows of your mind all along, coarse laxity. As mentioned earlier, the symptom of this attentional disorder is that your attention succumbs to dullness, which causes it to largely disengage from its meditative object. The Tibetan word for laxity has the connotation of sinking. It's as if the attention, instead of rising to the object, sinks down from it into the recesses of the mind. The attention fades, as it were, but instead of fading out, it's more like fading in, stepping onto a slippery slope that leads down to sluggishness, lethargy, and finally sleep. This is a peaceful state of mind, so the ignorant may mistake it for the attainment of shamatha, which literally means quiescence, tranquility, and serenity. True shamatha is imbued not only with a degree of stability far beyond that achieved at this stage of attentional practice, but also with an extraordinary vividness that one has hardly begun to develop at this point in the training. In the fifth stage, you rise to the challenge of overcoming coarse laxity without destabilizing your attention. In addition to the persistent problem of medium excitation, you now have the task of recognizing and counteracting a medium degree of laxity. When this degree of laxity sets in, the object of meditation appears, but without much vividness. This is subtly different from coarse laxity, and you will discover that distinction only through practice. The primary challenge here is to overcome laxity without undermining stability. The way to counteract laxity is to arouse the attention, to take a greater interest in the object of meditation. Tibet, and this we saw in the earlier quote from the Panchen Lama, he says here in Attention Revolution, Tibetan contemplatives liken this to stringing a lute. If the strings are too taut, they may easily break under the strain. But if they are too slack, the instrument is unplayable. Likewise, the task at this point is to determine the proper pitch of attention. If you arouse the mind too much in your efforts to remedy laxity, it will easily fall into excitation. But if you relax too much, you will likely succumb to laxity. It's a delicate balancing act, and the only way you can meet this challenge is through your own experience, determining for yourself the suitable degree of effort to tune your attention. Buddhist contemplatives, and this is the quote from Chandra Goleman, he's referring here a little bit to this, I think. He says, Buddhist contemplatives have grappled with this dilemma for millennia, and they report that it takes great skill to solve it. Having achieved the third and fourth stage with the power of mindfulness, the fifth stage is achieved by the power of introspection. The power of introspection is the faculty of monitoring the quality of your attention, and this skill must now be honed so you can detect more and more subtle degrees of laxity and excitation. And that's what we'll be seeing over the next couple of stages. So let's go now to stage six. Stage six is pacified attention. And now we've overcome the resistance to training. So now we have no resistance to training at all. And the power is the power of introspection. Introspection is getting much, much better. Now what problems persist here, maybe a bit surprised to see this, it says desire, depression, lethargy, drowsiness. And this is very well known here in these middling stages, particularly around this stage six, is that as our mind is settling down, becoming more stable and more clear, we are literally dredging the depths of our psyche. So a lot of stuff that we normally have been suppressing is really starting to really come up now. So we can have a lot of this desires and depression and lethargy, drowsiness. A lot of these things can be surfacing now that we've been holding down. But of course, qualitatively, it's a much different experience here than these same experiences at stage one or two. Because early in the practice, if these practice things get come up, craving, desire, depression, lethargy, drowsiness, we're completely caught up in these mental afflictions and these states of mind. But here at stage six, when these come up, we don't contract around them. We simply observe them arise and pass. So this is very much a healing practice where we are releasing all of this stuff that's coming up from the deeper levels of our mind. But still here in the imbalances, we still have a medium degree of laxity now, but only subtle excitation now. So our mental engagement is still interrupted. We're still interrupted by medium laxity and subtle excitation. Sense of achievement. Now the amount of mental events is slowing down even more. And now it's like a slow moving river of thoughts appearing in the mind. So much less mental content coming up in the mind now. And then we go around the corner, the bend. This power is the power of enthusiasm. So now to go to stage 7, 8, we have a lot of enthusiasm and joy that propels us to these higher levels. So stage 7 is fully pacified attention. So now we've completely pacified these mental afflictions, these attachment and depression, melancholy, lethargy from stage 6. They're completely gone now, pacified. What persists is that there is still some subtle laxity and subtle excitation there. And we see that the monkey is still there. We're just about to say goodbye to the monkey, subtle excitation. And then you see a tiny little bit of black on the back of the elephant, so subtle laxity. So here, if some little bit of subtle laxity or subtle excitation does arise in meditation, we quickly dispel it, quickly dispel it. But we still have, our mental engagement is still interrupted a little bit by that subtle laxity, subtle excitation. But now the quality of our experience is one of familiarity. We're becoming very familiar with this practice now. And again, very little mental content arising, thoughts coming up. So it's like a slow moving river of thoughts. So it's very, really, mind is really slowing down in terms of mental activity now. So much so that when we get to stage 8 now, single pointed attention, now our mind has become completely still. So that's why it's called single pointed attention. So now we don't have any subtle laxity, subtle excitement, excitation. Now we can, what we achieve is we can sustain that without any excitation or laxity. We still need to be wary of that laxity and excitation. So we still need a little bit of effort to start the meditation, to be watchful of that. So the impulses, so the imbalances that are there is still, there's the impulse for subtle laxity excitation to arise. But now the mental engagement is uninterrupted. We're not interrupted at all by any subtle excitation or laxity. And so the quality of our experience is now stillness. The mind is completely still, completely on the object. And so now it's now the slow moving river of thoughts is emptied into a still lake. So our discursive mind is completely calm, like an ocean unmoved by waves. So that's single pointed attention. And so then to get to stage 9 is attentional balance. And what we achieve here now is it becomes completely effortless, spontaneous, that we can effortlessly slip into meditation and slip out without any effort at all. And we do this through the power of familiarity. What problems persist is that attentional imbalances may reoccur in future. If we stop the practice, then they may slowly start to come back. So the imbalances is the causes are still there. We haven't got rid of the causes, but the mental engagement now is completely effortless. It's completely spontaneous, that we spontaneously, effortlessly in this attentional balance, flawless meditation. And so the quality of our experience is said to be one of perfection. And it's using a slightly different metaphor for the mind being still instead of an ocean, like the king of mountains, Mount Meru, but the mind is completely still and quiet, completely on the object. but still we haven't achieved shamatha. So as we're going to see in the next session, is that to move from this stage 9 to shamatha, we go through a radical transition. We achieve this, which we looked at earlier in terms of the faults and the antidotes, the fourth antidote for laziness, pliancy, that we achieve this physical or mental pliancy. And that is what enables us to actually achieve shamatha. And we'll be looking at that in the next session, the achievement of shamatha. So just again, reading a little bit from Attention Revolution on this 9th stage before we go to the meditation practice again. So this is on page 143. He says, with only the slightest exertion of effort, you proceed from the 8th stage to the 9th, known as attentional balance. You are now able to maintain flawless samadhi, in other words, concentration, effortlessly and continuously for at least 4 hours. Due to the power of deep familiarization with this training, you can slip into meditative equipoise free of even the subtlest traces of laxity and excitation with no effort at all. This is not to say that your attention is irreversibly balanced. If for some reason you discontinue the practice, you'll find that laxity and excitation erode your attentional equipoise. They have not been irreversibly eliminated. But if you maintain a contemplative lifestyle and keep your attention honed through regular practice, this wonderful degree of sanity can be yours for life. Contemplatives who achieve this 9th stage of attentional balance describe the quality of the experience simply as perfection. The mind has come to a yet deeper state of stillness and serenity, likened now to Mount Meru, the king of mountains. It would be understandable to conclude that you have now fully achieved shamatha. You are almost there. So in the next session, we'll look at the next stage, how to get to shamatha, and then also beyond shamatha. So we'll leave the stages of progress there, and we'll go back to the actual practice, the shamatha practice we're doing at the moment. And the practice is the mindfulness of breathing, focusing on the abdomen. So what we've seen here is that, of course, on the basis of relaxation, we work on improving stability of attention. So for stability of attention, it's important to maintain this continuity of mindfulness throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. So we're improving stability of attention, but balanced with relaxation, not losing relaxation. So what we've seen in the descriptions now of some of those middling stages is that we need to have that combination of being very relaxed and focused. Now in daily life, we tend to oscillate between two extremes. Either when we're focused, we tend to be tense, or when we're relaxed, we tend to be very dull and drowsy. So what we're trying to do is combine the two here. And very often in meditation, in shamatha practice, we start to drift either towards agitation, tension, or distraction, or we start to drift towards dullness, lethargy, drowsiness. So what we can do is we can balance on every breath. And you might like to experiment with that in this meditation. And that is that the out-breath is a natural time to relax and release any tension. And the in-breath is a natural time to arouse and refresh the focus, to overcome laxity. So you might like to experiment with this balancing on every breath. Relaxing and releasing on the out-breath, sharpening the focus on the in-breath. That way we can remain relaxed and focused and alert. And again, counting the breath as an optional extra if you find it helpful, if you find you're heavily distracted. And you also, if you do find counting the breath helpful, use it. And you might like to experiment with some different methods. We only introduced one method so far, counting at the end of the in-breath and counting from 1 up to 10. So you might like to experiment with, for example, counting more often, like 1 on the in-breath, 2 on the out-breath, 3 on the in-breath, 4 on the out-breath. So more often counting, or maybe every second or third breath, count 1. Also, you might try noting if you prefer, instead of counting, noting, like breathing in, breathing out, or simply in, out. So you can experiment. And if it helps, then use it. But only bring the counting or noting in if you need it and if you find it helpful. So let's do that practice again, the mindfulness of breathing, focusing on the area of the abdomen. Finding a nice, comfortable posture. Back straight. And allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed. And having established a good posture, then keeping the body as still as possible, avoiding any unnecessary movement. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Simply get out of the way and let the body breathe itself. And with each out breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. And simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Resting in stillness. And then from that stillness, start to become aware of the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. maintaining a balanced mind, a balance of relaxation and focus. And we can balance on each breath. We can use the out breath as an opportunity to relax and release any tightness or tension. And we can use each in breath as an opportunity to arouse and refresh the focus, to sharpen the focus. In this way, having a relaxed and stable mind. And we can bring the meditation to a close. Now we have some time for question answer. So do we have any questions, Miffy?
Well, we'll give everyone a chance to type into the chat. But so I was just wondering with the having heard about some of our students having done TM or transcendental meditation, that we're that would fit into this scheme of those nine stages?
I have no really skill or knowledge of transcendental meditation, so I really couldn't comment on that.
Right, because I don't have any kind of idea except what I've heard from David Lynch, who uses it to get all of his ideas for his movies. So
I really couldn't comment on that. I haven't really had any teachings on transcendental meditation, so I don't know exactly what's involved in that system of practice, so I couldn't really comment on that.
Okay. And then when with the focusing on the abdomen, my distractions then is that I just become very aware of everything else going on in the body.
Well, that's better than getting caught up in lots of thoughts. That's already narrowing down. And I think for many of us, and that's one of the advantages with mindfulness of breathing in the modern world, is many of us are so much caught up in our thinking and everything, discursive thoughts, we've lost touch with our body. So to bring the attention into the body is a very helpful thing to get in touch with our body. We've lost contact with it. So initially, I wouldn't worry too much about when you're focusing on the abdomen, noticing other things in the body. I wouldn't worry about that too much. In fact, that can be a little bit of a short-term anchor to help us avoid getting caught up in all sorts of other thoughts. But of course, if you do notice you're moving to other areas of the body, just keep bringing yourself back to the abdomen. That's all.
Yeah. No, it was quite an anchor like that. Yeah. Then Andrew asked, do each of the stages have associated analytical meditations that are recommended to accompany it to assist with building insight?
So remember, the shamatha is what's called stabilizing meditation. So often, you know, we can talk about all sorts of many different types of meditations and very common, I think, in the Galuk school and other schools as well, to categorize meditations into two groups, stabilizing and analytical. And shamatha is stabilizing meditation. So it's to stabilize the mind, to simply develop attention skills, whereas pretty well all the other meditations are analytical, where we investigate or we analyze in terms of the vipassana, we're analyzing the nature of reality, or in some of the preliminary practices, we're investigating the precious human life and death and so forth. Or in compassion practice, we're investigating the situation of ourselves and others and the causes of suffering and so forth. So these are all analytical meditations. Whereas in shamatha practice, we're not doing any analysis at all. We're simply focusing on an object so that we can then on that basis engage in all these other analytical meditations. So you wouldn't want to really bring in any analytical meditations in shamatha unless you were sort of stuck somewhere, and then you can sort of investigate what's going on there. But generally in shamatha practice, you wouldn't want to be bringing in investigation analysis. That's a sort of it would be just another distraction.
So then, Glenn, would that be something that you do in a different meditation session, your analytical meditations?
No, I mean, if you're doing shamatha practice and you are constantly, regularly getting stuck at some point, then when that point arises, then you could stop your shamatha practice and just analyze, investigate that situation and so forth at that time. Or you could do it outside as well, of course.
And so then if you have other practices to do, studying the Lam Rim or visualization practices, would you do them in the same session as these meditations or separate them?
Ooh, that's a big topic. You can do both. I mean, you could, like, for example, in your morning practice, you could, for example, say, start with some shamatha, mindfulness of breathing, to calm the mind, focus the mind for a period of time, and then move on to whatever practice you do, analytical or even sadhana practice or Lam Rim practice or compassion practice. So you could, like, do that. You could, like, have, you know, in a, say, 45-minute session, do 20 minutes on shamatha and then 20 minutes on some sort of more analytical practice. So you could do that, or you could do them as separate practices. So both are okay. But I wouldn't be sort of just mixing them around, you know, like a little bit of this and then a bit of this and then back here and back there. But you could do two types of meditation in one session. And then probably the best option would be to start with the shamatha and then the other practice. But actually, on some, depending on the practice, it may actually be better to do the opposite. Like if you're doing some sort of devotional practice, you may find that doing that first uplifts the mind and your mind is very uplifted and joyful. And then you bring that into your shamatha practice. So that could be a good prelude to shamatha. So both options would be okay.
Okay. And then Richard asks, once a person attains stage 9 and beyond, does such a person need to be separated from the 21st century world to maintain that level of concentration?
I think once you've achieved that level, then I think being in the world would probably be not a problem. Because of that high level of achievement. In fact, what we often talk about is, in general, in spiritual training, we talk about conducive conditions. And often as us beginners, conducive conditions often implies, you know, find a quiet place, pull back a little bit, give yourself a bit of space, surround yourself with like-minded people, you know, protect yourself a little bit. But actually, you'll find that in a lot of systems of practice, when you achieve higher levels, and we're talking much higher levels, then actually you will need to go out into the world more to progress. Because, you know, if we're always surrounding ourselves with nice people, how are we ever going to perfect patience? It would be impossible. How are we going to fully develop compassion and loving kindness if everyone's nice to us? It won't work. So actually, at the very high levels, you probably will need to be more in the world. But certainly for the shamatha practice, until you achieve those levels, you would need to give yourself very conducive conditions to develop those levels. Otherwise, the stimulus that we receive will disturb us, because we won't be able to deal with it effectively.
So as an aside, this isn't from Richard, but is that kind of like doing your ultimate exam when you've been, you know, practicing like this and then going out into the world and seeing if you lose your equilibrium?
Yeah. I mean, there was, quite well known. There was, I think, some American, I can't remember, who was an American Buddhist, and he said something like, oh, you're so patient or something, what was it? I can't remember now. Something about go and live with your mother-in-law for 2 weeks. You know, so so basically, you know, we need to find the conditions appropriate to our level for it to be conducive, I mean.
And then from Andrew, are there any risks with meditation? On one weekend retreat that he went to, he was left with a great sadness, and his wife banned him from any more retreats.
I mean, anything we do in life, there's a risk if we don't do it correctly. So, you know, what we don't want to do is jump off on some weekend retreat or week retreat where they're promising you enlightenment or promising you all this sort of stuff, because, you know, that's generally they're looking for a some sort of little bit of bliss or something like that. So, you know, we need to make sure that we follow a correct method of practice with a qualified teacher, and then, like everything, I think there's no danger then. There's a danger if we follow some teacher who's not very qualified, or we just really try and do it ourselves. It's the same with everything. If we're learning something and we're trying to do it by ourselves, then there's very much a danger we go astray or we don't have a qualified teacher. So I think if we do it in a very systematic way, then I don't see there's any danger. In fact, you know, I think then his wife would be encouraging him to go, because once he comes back from those weekend retreats, she finds he's more calm and more kind and more loving to her and that. So she's like, please go again, please go again.
Okay, everyone says thank you.
Okay, I think we've run out of time there. So let's just finish with dedicating. So again, let's dedicate according to whatever motivation you set at the beginning of the session. So next session is on Thursday, session 6. We'll be moving to the next shamatha practice of the breath, that is focusing at the entrance of the nostrils. And also we're going to be looking at actually the process of actually achieving shamatha and what shamatha really means and what sorts of benefits do we get from having that, achieve that goal of shamatha. And then we'll be looking at what's beyond shamatha in terms of samadhi practice, but also what can we do with shamatha in terms of other practices. So that's some of the topics that we'll be looking at on Thursday. So until Thursday, stay safe, stay well. See you same time Thursday. Bye now.